love with someone, he has got to overcome one obstacle that's always in the way. Finding words to pop the question gives him mental indigestion. Possibly you'll get me when I say, ooh, stole my heart away. Ooh, make me dream all day. Dreams I know can never come true. Seems as though I'd ever be blue. Well, you ought to guess who, no one but you.
That's the big song from a musical called Sonny, which had tunes by Jerome Kern. That was the very first musical, very first show into the Her Majesty's Theatre in Sydney in 1927. Not that it was called Her Majesty's then, of course. It was a real Her Majesty's, the first Her Majesty's down in Pitt Street. Now, it was called The Empire. The Empire in a little street off Railway Square. Not a particularly good theatre part of town in those days or in these. But the reason why the theatre didn't do terribly well in its early years as a live theatre can be ascribed more to the onset of depression and other factors rather than that it was at the wrong end of the city. It was built, the Empire in Sydney, by a syndicate which was headed by the noted gambler and sportsman Rufe Naylor. They reckoned they were capitalised at £120,000. And the theatre opened on February the 27th, 1927, with that show, Sonny. There were imported stars, Win Richmond, Fred Hyder, Van Lowe, Beatrice Kay, and Queenie Ashton, who came to Australia to play in that show the very first time she came to us, and happily she stayed with us ever since. The Australian comedian Fred Blewett was in it as well, and the producer was E.C. Rowles, who had a well-deserved reputation for staging great big musicals. One of the things about the Empire in those days, looking back over the programmes, the general colour scheme, says a handout, ranges upwards from royal blue carpets to powder blue, ivory and gold. The drop curtain has cost $1,000 in powder blue velour with gold trimmings. One of the unusual things about the Empire was that it didn't have boxes in the accepted sense of the word. I think probably from the beginning, but certainly later on in its career, they had a kind of stage box on the stalls level of fairly large dimensions, would seat about 12 or 14 people. And then they had 24 loaves which fronted the dress circle in a series of sort of little scallop shell shapes. They were in place of the usual boxes. That first production of Sonny did really very well. It ran for months, over 150 performances. It cost £19,000, it was said at the time, and they made a profit of £13,000 onto it. And then it was sold to the Fuller people, who took it interstate. This was one of the reasons that the Rufe Naylor group had difficulty in making money at the Empire, of course. They only had one theatre, and they were never able to get a theatre of their own in any other capital city. After Sonny came another musical, The Student Prince, with James Liddy, and a star with a very unlikely name, Elsie Gurgley. That made a profit too, it said, ran about 3 months, and that one was sold to J.C. Williamson's to take interstate. Then things started to go a little bit wrong. There was a show called Tweaky, which glorified the Australian girl. That ran not so well as the other two had done. Then came things like The Film Girl, Top Hole, Bubbles, all review-type shows. And then slowly film started to creep in as half a program, and then at the end of 1929 as the whole double bill. There were no more live shows at the Empire until December the 27th, 1948, when the Tivoli Circuit people came in there. You see, they had grand opera down at their normal Tivoli home of vaudeville and variety, so they needed somewhere else to put their variety shows. First star into the revivified empire was two-ton Tessie O'Shea.
I'm so glad you want to hear this old banjo of mine. You know, I've been playing it since I was knee-high to a duck. It was through this banjo that I've got here. I got a nickname and a signature tune. Stuck to me many, many years now. I'm just singing. Perhaps a few of you have never heard it. So for you, my loves, I want you to know there's only two of us left. Davy Crockett and myself. Down in Nashville, Tennessee, there's a sight you ought to see. But as long as you can get down there, I tell you a whole, so listen to me. Now there's a gal called Tessie Town. She weighs about 400 pounds. She's that fair, but she don't care, because the boys all hang around. They call her two-ton Tessie from Tennessee. Hold six fellas upon her knee. When she does, all the fun begins. They play tennis on her double chin. Cause the rise in the price of meat. It's been 10 years since she saw her feet. Sugar Ray had given up his gym. He ran around her once just to keep in trim. They call her two-ton Tessie. Two-ton Tessie from Nashville, Tennessee. And the people had two-ton Tessie from Tennessee. Goes in swimming up to her knees. Once she went in up to her neck, the tide rose up and made the town a wreck. She was hit on a railroad track. The engine struck her and bounced right back. Her appendix had to come out fast. They couldn't operate, oh boy, they had to blast. They call it two-ton Tessie. Two-ton Tessie from Nashville, Tennessee.
Two-ton Tessie O'Shea was finished, the Empire Theatre really knew that it was back in the live theatre business. Then, that was just at the end of 48 and into the early part of 49. In February 49, a show came into the Empire, which was one of the most remarkable shows that it ever housed in its whole 43 years of existence. It was the Kiwis Concert Party, the Army Concert Party, which had been attached to the Kiwi Expedition Forces from New Zealand. They came over to Australia just after the war ended. Nobody thought they were going to do particularly well, but that they thought that they might be a small audience, at least, to have a look at a concert party which had been entertaining the troops all around the Middle East area and other places, just to see what a concert party was like for the soldiers. And then they lobbed into the Comedy Theatre in Melbourne, and they played for months and months and months. Audiences just simply couldn't get enough of this, admittedly, very clever concert party. And as they got more and more money out of admission prices, they started to update their shows with better scenery and better costumes. And, well, they were a success story which I suppose is impossible to repeat today. Then, in early 49, they came to the Empire Theatre in Sydney. Now, the Empire was a very much bigger theatre than the Comedy. At least twice, or maybe more, the capacity. It was a great, funny, fan-shaped auditorium. It was a very odd-shaped site, as a matter of fact, a diamond shape. There were about 100 seats in the back row of the back circle at the Empire. And there were some thoughts as to whether this concert party, which had been used to the more cramped or confined area of the Comedy Theatre, which was a nice, fairly intimate little theatre, very wide but still intimate, whether the Kiwis could get out into this enormous great auditorium. Well, they certainly did, because they played a whole year in Sydney doing three separate shows. And that's one of the most remarkable success stories in Australian theatrical history of the last 30 or 40 years. One of the special people associated with the Kiwis was their best female impersonator, John Hunter. And one of the most popular things he did throughout the whole series of shows that the Kiwis presented was the balcony scene from Private Lives, which, dressed as Amanda, he played both parts, the Elliot part and the Amanda part. And just very fortunately, he managed to record it too.
What are you doing here?
I'm on my honeymoon.
Very interesting, so am I.
Well, I hope you're enjoying it.
It hasn't started yet.
Neither has mine.
Are you happy?
Perfectly. Are you?
Ecstatically.
What's she like?
Fair, very pretty. Plays the piano beautifully.
Very comforting.
How's yours?
Well, I'd rather not discuss him.
Very well, it really doesn't matter. He'll probably come popping out and I shall see for myself.
Have you known her long?
About 4 months. We met on a house party in Norfolk.
Very flat, Norfolk.
There's no need to be rude.
It was no reflection on her, unless, of course, she made it flatter.
Your voice takes on an acid quality whenever you mention her.
Well, I swear I'll never mention her again.
Good. Then I'll keep off yours.
Thank you.
John Hunter from the Kiwis, doing the balcony scene from Private Lives. You know, theatre, in its history, is known by the stars it keeps. And it's always a pleasure to me to know that Roy Rean played at the Empire before his death. He was there in 1949 in a show called Hell's a Poppin', based on the Olsen and Johnson success from America. It did moderately well, not enormously well, and at the end of the Sydney run, they slipped in a week of macaque moments. Roy, of course, by this time was a big star in Australian radio. And as Mo Macaque had his little entourage of people like Lasho, Hal Lashwood, and Horrible Herbie, and Young Harry, who was always copying it from various sources. So Mo is just one of the big stars that played the Empire. And this is the sort of thing he was doing.
Where are you, Dad?
Here I am, young Harry!
Hey, Dad, there's a letter here from Al Butcher. He says you haven't paid your bill for 6 months.
The cheeky possums! He ordered out my system of paying bills. Every month I put all my accounts into a hat, shuffle them up, draw out three and pay them. And if that flavor butcher isn't careful, he won't even get into next month's shuffle. Anyhow, I should worry. I got a new butcher. Angus McAllister McTavish.
Oh, he's a Scotchman, eh?
Yes, and he specializes in his national dish, Scotch pheasant.
What's a Scotch pheasant, Dad?
It's saveloy with a feather on it.
I suppose you spend all your time looking in his window, do you?
Don't be silly, Harry. What would I look like with me face stuck in a butcher's shop window?
A pig's head.
Harry, cop this.
Oh. Hello, Mo.
Oh, it's horrible, Herbie. Horrible. I've got to give you a home-cooked meal. I've got to cook myself.
Oh, I bet you'll taste awful.
Awful, you're just a brewer. Nothing but a brewer.
What's a brewer?
A backward warp.
Macaque moments with Roy Rean. And so, time went on. One other name that I want to mention right now, because he comes early into this revivified part of the Empire story, was Borobansky, heading his own Borobansky Ballet. Borrow was associated with the Empire from, well, the late 40s, early 50s, right up till his death in 1959. And the company which he founded, which has now developed into the Australian Ballet Company, of course has been a tenant of the Empire and later Her Majesty's Theatre many, many times. During Borrow's various programmes from 51 through to 59, don't forget that Margot Fontaine was soloist, guest soloist with the company in 1957. Ballet's often played at the Empire, you know. The New York City Ballet was here in 1958, and they gave a whole and remarkable series of programs. And so, too, in that same year, did a company from the Royal Ballet in London. The thing about the Empire was that it really was too big for comfort. These days, you don't want an enormous theatre seating something like 3,000 people for musical shows. Ruth Naylor had the bright idea, you see, that he'd put on enormously big musicals at cheap prices. It only cost 2 and 6 and 5 and 6 to get in when he opened the theatre in 1927, and he thought by having an enormous capacity he'd make a lot of money fast. Well, by 1953 it was obvious that something had to be done about the size of the Empire Theatre. J.C. Williamson had secured a lease from the motion picture concern which owned the theatre, and they decided that they'd reconstruct. What they did was take the side walls of the auditorium and sort of shrink them inwards and brought the capacity down to about 1,750. They changed the stage opening a little, mostly in connection with that shrinkage of the walls routine. They made the walls more attractive to look at. They did some new seating. The whole theatre took on a whole new look and was a much better theatre from all points of view. They decided that they must open their new Empire Theatre with a great big show, and so they chose South Pacific.
We got sunlight on the sand, we got moonlight on the sea, we got mangoes and bananas you can pick right off a tree. We got volleyball and ping pong and a lot of dandy games. What ain't we got? We ain't got dames. We get packages from home, we get movies, we get shows, we get speeches from our skipper and advice from Tokyo Rose. We get letters doused with poison, we get dizzy from the smell. What don't we get? You know darn well. We got nothing to put on a clean white suit for. We got nothing to look masculine and cute for. There is nothing like a dame. Nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name that is anything like a dame. We feel lonely and we long for the fair and gentle sex. We would like to feel a feeling of some arms around our necks. We feel hungry as the wolf does when he met Red Riding Hood. What don't we feel? We don't feel good. Lots of things in life are beautiful, but brother, there is one particular thing that is nothing whatsoever in any way, shape, or form like any other. There is nothing like a dame, nothing in the world. There is nothing you can name that is anything like a dame. There are no books like a dame, and nothing looks like a dame. There are no drinks like a dame, and nothing thinks like a dame. And nothing acts like a dame, or attracts like a dame. There ain't a thing that's wrong with any man here, but it can be cured by wooden and near. A curly womanly
July 1953, South Pacific opening the reconstructed Empire Theatre. Who remembers now the people who came out to play the leads in South Pacific in those years, those many years ago? Well, if you've got a good memory, you'll remember that the female lead, Ensign Nellie Forbush, was played by Mary LaRoche. In later years, a somewhat dimmer Mary LaRoche turned up on American television programs quite a bit. Emile de Beck was played by a man called Richard Collette. Virginia Paris came to Australia to play Bloody Mary in that production. And Luther Billis, the main comedy role, was taken by an American called Leonard Stone. South Pacific was just the first of a whole series of big American musicals which came into the Empire. One of them, in April 1955, was Paint Your Wagon, in which the Australian performer Alec Kellaway gave a lovely performance as Ben Rumson. Two American imported leads came out to play the juveniles. This was in the days when automatically you brought out some American or other to play leads in shows, no matter how good or how bad they were. Lynn Lyons was the girl's name, Richard Curry was the man. They were both adequate, but I think it was quite nice when they went back to America and local people took over. For instance, Bill Newman took over for Richard Curry, and that was the foundation of a number of big starring roles for Bill. Jill Perryman was in that production of Paint Your Wagon. She played a rather severe Quaker lady, which is quite a change of pace for lovely, bouncing, bumptious Jill. Paint Your Wagon, April 1955. Remember this tune from it. A year later, May 1956, Can-Can. Once again, with an imported star or two, Sheila Arno came out to play La Moma Pistache, but Bill Newman got a chance to play opposite her in the leading male role of Judge Forestier. Dancers who were featured in that production were Eleanor Triber, who was another American, and the Australian Kevin Johnson. Then, June 1957, and the Pajama Game. And here, a lovely breakthrough, Australian leads, Bill Newman and Tony Lamond, with Keith Peterson as the principal comedian. Tiki Taylor was in that show, and also Jill Perryman, once again playing a character role before she was to break out in later years into really big solo starring pieces. Pajama Game, June 57. The Pajama Game played from June through to November of 1957. Let's take a look at 1959, which was a pretty good year for the Empire Theatre. Among other things, it contained a show called Many Happy Returns, with stars like Jenny Howard, Jim Gerald, Queenie Paul, and Gladys Moncrief, who, during this season, made her last appearances on the stage in Sydney. It was advertised that way, and that's the way it has remained. Gladys Moncrief saying goodbye to her Sydney public in Many Happy Returns in 1959 at the Empire Theatre, just another feather in this particular theatre's collective cap. Another very big feather for the 59 year for the Empire was the appearance of Danny Kaye in June of that year. Let me quote to you a little bit of the review by Lindsay Brown in the Sydney Morning Herald of Danny Kaye. It says, Danny Kaye's opening show at the Empire last night was a side-busting, brain-tickling, heart-thumping escapade in non-stop laughter such as few of us have ever had. And then, talking about Danny's trickery with words in another part of the review, he says, a madder mince of human viva voce was probably never heard on a Sydney stage.
It all began when I was born, a month too soon. My ma was frightened by a runaway saloon. Pa was forced to be a hobo because he played the oboe, and the oboe, it is clearly understood, is an ill wind that no one blows good. I'll never forget the morning that Grandpa ate the awning to impress a pretty lady who went for men that were shady. Then my Uncle Josiah lit the great Frisco fire, ran off to Hawaii with the O'Leary cow, which his loving wife resented and thereupon invented a rolling pin that strikes and then says, pow. And I'm the result of the twisted eugenics of this family of inbred schizophrenics, the end of a long, long line of pets I designed. Women's hats. I'm Anatole LaBallis, I shrieked with chic. My hat of the week, cause 64 says, three runaway horses. I'm Anatole LaBallis, the hats I sell make husbands yell. Is that the hat or a two-room flat? Let me get my paw on a little piece of straw, and voila, a chapeau. At 60 bucks a throw. It's how I pull and chew one of the little things I do. Like placing yards of lacing or a bicycle bill for two on it. The little ones, the big ones, the sat on by a pig ones, the foolish ones that lurch, and the ghoulish ones that lurch. The one called whiskey sour, designed for the cocktail hour. A little snip of potato chip, and a trifle of the Eiffel Tower. I am Anatole LaBallis, I must design. I'm just like wine, I go to your head. Give me thread and the needle, I itch, I twitch, to stitch. I'm a glutton for cutting, for putting with a button to snip and plug, snip and tug, fix and trim, from the trim to stack bars. It's the same. And why do I sew each new chapeau with the style they must look positively grim in? Strictly between us, entre nous, I hate women.
Danny Kaye at the Empire in June 1959. A year later, another superstar for a short season at the theatre, the elegant boulevardier Maurice Chevalier.
Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal ya? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you and I should get together. How about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never meet, Cecilia. Why do we two keep on wasting time? Oh, Cecilia said that you'll be mine.
Many funny things occur while the boys are courting her. I refer to one case in particular. She went with a boy named Joe, who was always living so. When he asked his miss for a little kiss, it would sound just like this.
Does your mother know you're out, Cecilia? Does she know that I'm about to steal you? Oh my, when I look in your eyes, something tells me you're together. How about a little kiss, Cecilia? Just a kiss, you'll never meet. Oh, Cecilia, why do we two keep on wasting time? Ah, Cecilia, say that you'll be mine.
Cecilia, say that you'll be mine.
Maurice Chevalier played the Empire in March and April of 1960. Up to this time, J.C. Williamson had just leased the theatre. Now they decided to take the plunge and buy it outright, which they did for a price said to be around £150,000. They also decided to change the name of the theatre, call it Her Majesty's Theatre, to match their Her Majesty's Theatres in other capital cities. You obviously needed a big show to start off a new regime, and a new theatre, at least given a famous name, revived in Sydney. So, what else but the best and biggest show that they could possibly put on, My Fair Lady, which was the longest run ever in this house. It ran for 17 consecutive months. Bunty Turner played the lead, Robin Bailey was in it, Richard Walker was in it, everybody was in My Fair Lady. And 17 months run, you know, is a remarkable achievement for any show in any theatre. Strangely and ironically enough, it was scheduled to come back to Her Majesty's as the next show before fire got in the way. But let's not talk about this year. Let's go back to 1960 and May and My Fair Lady.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
The rain in Spain stays mainly in the plain.
By George, she's got it. By George, she's got it. Now, once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that soggy plain?
In Spain.
In Hartford, Harrisford, and Hampshire,
hurricanes hardly happen. How kind of you to let me come.
Now, once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that lofted plain?
In Spain, in Spain.
The rain
is mainly, mainly in the plain. The rain is mainly, mainly in the plain.
Once again, where does it rain?
On the plain, on the plain.
And where's that foggy plain?
In Spain, in Spain.
The rain, the rain, the rain, the rain, the rain, the rain.
My Fair Lady played at Her Majesty's in Sydney from May 1960 to October 1961, 17 months. The very next show in was also a musical, Bye Bye Birdie. It played for 1 month. I was away on my holidays and missed it altogether. But then, that's show business, isn't it? Some other names from around this period. Victor Borger played seasons at Her Majesty's in 1962 and 1963. Marcel Marceau made his first Sydney appearances in 1963, a year which also brought another flop musical called Sail Away, music, book, lyrics by Noel Coward. It did about 2 months in the latter half of 1963, and it was one of the most unappreciated, I was going to say, most underrated musicals ever to be seen at this theatre. It should have done an awful lot better, but somehow it didn't. Maggie Fitzgibbon came back to Australia to play in it, which was a great shame because she gave a lovely performance and just played it for, you know, a few months here, a few months there. Not nearly enough for its style and her style too. Kevin Colson was the young man, and of course the music was Well, Noel Coward.
Any other day. This is something special and apart. Something to remember when the coldness of December chills my heart. Something very strange is happening to me. Every face I see seems to be smiling. All the sounds I hear, the buses changing gears, suddenly appear to be beguiling. Nobody's melancholy, nobody's sad. Not a single shadow on the scene. Some magician's spell has made this magic start, and I feel I want to hold each shining moment in my heart. Something strange and gay on this enchanted day seems to be happening to me. Something very strange is happening to me. Every cat I see to be purring, and I can clearly tell in every clanging bell some forgotten melody recurring. Tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, beggar, man, or thief, every single leaf on every tree seems to be aware of something in the air. And if only I were younger, I'd put ribbons in my hair. Something strange and gay on this romantic day seems to be happening to me.
Another song from a flop musical, Sail Away. Let's talk now of one musical, though, that was anything but a flop. It played from February to August of 1964. It was called How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. And in its opening stages in Sydney, it starred Len Goshman as the very cheeky little fellow who gets on in business without, well, with trying a lot, but trying in a rather unscrupulous way. Later on, Jim Kenny came out to Australia and took over from Len Goshman. Edwin Steff from America was very good in How to Succeed, and so was an American called Jay Gerber. It was a lovely show.
New Rochelle, that's the place where the mansion will be for me and my darling bright young man I picked out for marrying me. He'll do well, I can tell, so it isn't a moment too soon. plan on my life in New Rochelle. The wife of my darling tycoon.
Honey, you'll be in New Rochelle. Your darling tycoon will be here at the office. The future Mrs. Finch is in for some lonely nights.
Smitty, I'm prepared for exactly that sort of thing. I'll be so happy to keep his dinner warm while he goes onward and upward. Happy to keep his dinner warm till he comes wearily home from downtown. I'll be there waiting until his mind is clear while he looks through me. Right through me, waiting to say good evening, dear. I'm pregnant. What's new with you from downtown? Oh, to be loved by a man I respect, bask in the glow of his perfectly understandable neglect. Oh, to be loved in the aura of his frown, darling. Busy frown. Such heaven, wearing the wifely uniform while he goes onward and upward. Happy to keep his dinner warm till he comes wearily home from downtown. Happy
to keep his dinner warm from How to Succeed in Business without really trying. There are a lot of musical shows that come back to me from these comparatively recent years. At Her Majesty's in Sydney, Camelot, for instance. Hello, Dolly, which I enjoyed enormously. Carol Cook, the American star, was attacked on some quarters for being a little bit too much of a vulgarian, a bit too broadly playing, a bit too much milking the applause in the audience, but I loved every moment of her. I thought she was tremendously good. In fact, the whole show was tremendously good. And then let me talk about possibly the most exciting first night I ever spent in this theatre, when Jill Perryman, Australia's own in quotation marks, starred in Funny Girl in March 1966. I've seen a lot of demonstrations in the theatre of pleasure and applause, but the occasions in which an audience rises at a performer are comparatively few. They rose at Jill Perryman on that opening night of Funny Girl at Her Majesty's, and it was one of the most exciting things I can ever remember from that or any other theatre. The mixture pretty much as before. Her Majesty's was the Sydney home of opera and ballet. The Australian Opera was playing there until a week ago when fire wiped the theatre out. For good and all, it's hard to say yet. Another theatre to replace Her Majesty's will be built, the firm assures us, but just when and where is not decided. And so, let's leave our theatre story on a high note of success. One of the biggest hits ever at Her Majesty's was the Jerry Box Sheldon Harnick musical, Fiddler on the Roof. Given a splendid production whose backbone was a rock-steady performance by Hayes Gordon as Tebby the Nookman, Fiddler played 8 months at Her Majesty's in two separate seasons, a year apart, and then came back again to Sydney almost a year later for a third run, though this was uptown at the Theatre Royal. Maybe a bit fanciful, but I'm a romantic at heart. I like to think that the quiet strength of purpose which drove the people of Anatevka to strive and not to yield might give some inspiration for the creation of a third Her Majesty's Theatre for Sydney in the not-too-distant future.
Traditions for everything. How to sleep, how to eat, how to work, how to wear clothes. For instance, we always keep our heads covered and always wear a little prayer shawl. This shows our constant devotion to God. You may ask, how did this tradition get started? I'll tell you. I don't know. But it's a tradition. And because of our traditions, every one of us knows who he is and what God expects him to do.
Day and night must scramble for a living, be the wife and children, stay his daily present. Who has the right guest master of the house? Who had the final word?